This call is being recorded.
Good evening, everyone. This is the Your Gift conference call, and this is your host, Patrick Pete, the gift coach. And I have with me today, Alan Andrews, not the better half of the power business couple, his lovely wife. I don't know if she on, is Kim on yet?
She's not on yet. She's gonna call in. I'll patch her in when she calls. Yeah.
All right, and Milton Holt, the other co-host, the founder of the Winning Hand Strategies, he's come down with the bug, and I felt myself sort of having a little cough myself. But I am excited today because I have the privilege and the honor to introduce, I'm not sure if Victor is on yet. Victor, are you on yet?
I am here. How are you doing today,
Bobby? Awesome, Milton? Awesome. I want to make sure I give a proper introduction. This is my classmate, and he was our class president of Justin F. Kimball High School in Oak Cliff, Dallas, Texas. So you know we are Cowboys fans. But I digress. I want to tell you a little bit about Victor, and then I'm going to introduce him. Victor was our class president. He was, one of the more popular guys in school. Everybody loved Victor. Even when we were kids, you know, I always felt like, man, this is really a guy that's above his years in terms of how he carries himself. And, you know, so he was always, you know, that kind of guy who seemed to have his wits about him in all things. So you know, we sort of reconnected via Facebook, and I started to, you know, hear some of the things that Victor was doing, and his story is fascinating because you know, growing up in school, you know, Victor was, you know, class president, one of the, you know, probably graduated pretty high up in the class. And my claim to fame is that we had 329 students, and I graduated 279th out of those 329. So I keep that number. Me and Victor was talking about how they put your class rank on your last report card. So I had that stuck in my head. But I tell you that story because when I thought of Victor growing up, and then I think of Victor, you know, I always think, well, you know, Victor, man, he doesn't have any, he's not having any real issues. You think that when you're young, because, you know, he's popular, you know, he's a handsome guy, everybody likes him. But he has a fascinating story, because even the people that you think aren't having things that they need to overcome and things that they need to deal with, you know, never try to look at a person and think you know that their situation and what their hand is. So Victor, I don't want to talk too much about it, but I want to introduce you to the Your Gifts family, and sort of, you know, sort of tell your story. And you know, we've talked at length, and I wanted to, I felt it was important to share your story with my audience.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Patrick, for the and gentlemen, for the introduction. It's funny how to me is just, you know, a day in the life of Victor McLaughlin. But when other people kind of, you know, figure out and learn some of the things that I had to experience, it's, you know, it's kind of a wow. I get a wow, which is, again, it's very unusual and uncommon for me because it's just kind of life. Life just happens. I want to say again, thanks for having me on the show. Patrick, of course, we have been friends since the 80s, the mid 80s, early 80s. That's a long time, bro. I know we're dating ourselves, man, but that's a long time. But I really appreciate and have appreciated your kindness and your thoughtfulness even before you decided to take this step and embark on the chapter that you're in now. You have always been a very kind and thoughtful individual. Much respect. I remember we played football together, and neither one of us probably should have been out there on that field.
Yeah, basically.
But we did our thing and as best we could. Getting kind of to my story, which again is, you know, I was probably 27, 28 years old before I even realized that I had something worth sharing. when I graduated from high school. And at that time, it was a pretty mixed high school. And I'd been class president at least 3 years while I was there. And, you know, thought of myself as being a pretty good dude, you know, never made any trouble that I can remember or that I'm willing to claim to at this point. But, you know, life in high school was fun. It was exciting. Had a good time. But all the time I realized that I was not reading on a level that was sufficient enough to sustain what I call winning in education, doing a well enough job. So when I got to college and I had a lot of offers in track and field and a couple in football in the state of Texas to play, and I made a selection and arrived on campus and quickly realized that even though I was going to class every day and taking copious notes every day, I could not pass tests and I couldn't keep up with the reading assignments, and quickly learned or was told by my English, my freshman English professor, that not everyone who is on a college campus belongs on a college campus. And I said, well, what do you mean? I know, you know, it's obvious that you don't like me because I'm getting my papers back and my test, and there's more red ink than blue ink. And she said, well, you know, it's obvious that you don't understand a lot of things about grammar and syntax and spelling. And I said, yeah, I know I'm not the brightest, you know, but I'm here, you know, and tried to explain to her I belong here. And she said, well, you know, I could tell that, you know, you have your vocabulary as spoken vocabulary as well. But when you write, your vocabulary decreases. Why don't you mind, you know, do you mind reading, you know, some passages from this textbook? And of course, you know, to me, I got, you know, nervous and started to bristle because I knew I was a poor reader. I had always been a poor reader. But, you know, I said, I'm a great athlete and they're going to pay for me to go to school here. So being a poor reader is not really a problem, and that's what I kept telling myself. But at that time, I was 18 years old and could not get through a sentence without stumbling over half the words. And, you know, she continued to, you know, okay, read the next sentence. And about halfway through the paragraph, I locked up. I said, I refuse to read anymore. Obviously, you're trying to embarrass me. And she said, no, I'm just trying to point out what I've already realized, and that is that you don't belong here. And it was a university in South Texas. So I said, obviously, again, she doesn't like me, but she's right, unless I do something about it. And I was failing all my classes. And so I got special permission from the track coach to stay on the university while everyone else went home for the winter break. And for the first time in my life, I read several hours a day, every day. I grew up in a household where, you know, we had three televisions. You turn the TV on from the time you hit the door to the time you go to bed. You know, and sometimes you fall asleep while the TV's on, and three TVs are watching, you know, people in the house sleep. But that's kind of the lifestyle that I was ushered into. Some people call it a ghetto, you know, because you have more books, more TVs in the house than books. And it was so. I don't consider the situation I was in to be bleak. We had running water and lots of food and fresh clothes. So to me, that was more than enough to sustain what I would, you know, call quote unquote a good life. But back to the university, you know, here I am. The coach says, yeah, if you don't, you know, have a good or much better second semester, you're going to lose your scholarship. And I said, I understand. He said, what are you going to tell your mom? I said, I'm not going to tell her anything. He's going to fix this. I knew I couldn't return home a failure because I'd always been successful at whatever I tried. And friends from the neighborhood, some family members bought me clothes. And so they sent me off with this, you know, big hoorah. I could not return home a failure. There was no way. I probably would have just joined the military, waited a year and tell people, by the way, I joined the military. College wasn't for me. But I said, I have to try and figure this out. I love track and field. I love the situation I was in. So there I was. So the first book I read, and I'm talking about a college freshman, 18 years old. Actually, I'd already turned 19. The first book I read was a comic book, a collection of comics, and it was Good Grief, Charlie Brown. And it was just Sunday comics. It was a collection of them, probably 40 or 50. That was the first book I'd ever read in my life, cover to cover. I never read a magazine, newspaper. Sometimes I even had problems reading articles about me that were in the sports page. You know, I could make it out some of the words I didn't know. But whenever I was asked to read aloud in school, I always either made fun of it or just said, I don't feel like it, and got away with it. Well, got to college and not so much. So I read every day, picked up novels, textbooks, magazines, and for 3 weeks, I lived basically on ramen noodles and candy bars. And then if McDonald's had a 99 cent special, I'd run over to McDonald's and hit up everything I could on that 99 cent special and just read and walk around my dorm room and read aloud. And once I realized that hearing my own voice pronouncing these words correctly after a few days helped me pick up comprehension. So because before then, if I read a paragraph, I couldn't tell you what the paragraph said 5 seconds later. I couldn't get it. I couldn't grasp that. So after three and a half weeks, everyone came back, and a couple of people found out that I'd been there the whole time, and I just told them I needed to stay there and catch up on some things. And signed up for 21 hours, 7 classes. My track coach hit the roof. He said, you couldn't pass 5 classes. How is it you're going to pass 7? I said, I figured some things out, and we left it at that. So as a freshman, I was all conference in track and field and made a – 2.9 with 21 hours. And so basically taught myself how to read well enough to stay in school. And of course, my reading and comprehension continued to improve. And you look up and you graduate, get a master's degree, become a vice president at a bank all in your 20s. And again, I didn't know that I had anything to offer until I got a book deal from a New York publishing house. And, you know, they said, hey, we're going to give you a 2-book deal. We think you're going to make a good writer. We love the way you tell your stories. But what is it about you that you might want to share with your reading fans? And I said, I got nothing. And so they said, well, tell us kind of about yourself. And just through happenstance, which I say happenstance, that I brought up the idea that I was a late reader, I was a poor reader. And the publisher in New York said, wow, you should tell everybody that. I said, why would I want to tell people that? That's crazy. She said, because that might help young people. That might help mature adults who are still at that level know that they aren't the only ones. So for the last 20, 25 years, I've been touring the country, speaking to the colleges, kids, libraries about just that, about making the changes in life that can impact your life and your children's life. Right now, I'm married to a beautiful doctor, a surgeon, and I tell her all the time, if I was still reading at a 6th grade level, I wouldn't have had a shot. So I said all that to say, for everybody who's listening, or if you have a child who is a poor reader, or you feel like they're behind, or they're just not getting into school, there's a lot of things that can be done about it, and you can start on those today.
Awesome. Awesome. I want to highlight some things about what Victor said. I need y'all to really pay attention to some key elements to what Victor talked about. The thing that really sticks out to me is that the very thing that could have stumbled his life, that could have caused him the most problems, that could have prevented him from doing the things he wanted to do in life, is the very thing that is his gift. Because he's a writer. Victor, sort of tell him about just the being a vice president of a bank. So, a job that most people would mug their own mom for. But tell him about that process and how you evolved from that to where you're at now as a writer.
Okay. And again, to me, it's just kind of simple, the things that happen. But I was working on my master's program. I was working my first job out of college, undergrad, was working in a call center where I had to answer, you know, so many calls a day and respond to so many calls. And my name was always at the bottom of the performance list. And when they started hanging that list, you know, for everybody to see, you know, girls that thought I was cute was like, this guy must be stupid, you know, because he is awful. I was always at the bottom. But what I realized was this is not my thing. I'm going to do it a year, if I can make it. And after a year, I went and talked to management and said, hey, I can't do this. This isn't me. Is there something else in this, you know, it was eight floors. Is there something else in this entire mortgage business that I can do? And I was like, well, you know, you kind of, you know, you got to prove yourself. And so far, you're not doing very well. And I said, well, you hired me. You told me within a year I'd be looking at a management position, but nobody from my department has been moved up. And she said, well, you know, keep working on it and we'll see. After about a year and a half, I realized that I didn't belong there. So one day at lunch, I got a box from the garage and put all of my stuff in a box, went and told my boss. I said, I can't do this anymore. And she said, well, you got another job. I said, nope. She said, well, then why are you leaving? I said, this isn't for me. Walked my behind right out the door, waving goodbye to everybody who was still there. All these other people who had said the very same words that I had said, that the job was killing their soul and it was not for them, and they saw no upward mobility, yet they did it 2, 3, 5, 7, 10 years, the same job. So I was waiting tables and working on a master's program, and met a guy who was executive at a bank. And he said, hey, you know what? What are you doing here? And I said, I'm waiting tables. What are you talking about? He goes, you are very astute at taking care of us. We never have to ask you for anything. Your customer service is through the roof. You're a very thoughtful individual. You got a sense of humor. Why are you here? And I said, oh, I see what you mean. I'm working on a master's degree trying to figure out what I'm going to do next. And he said, would you be interested in becoming a banker? And I said, not at all. And, of course, he had a table full of people, and they all laughed. And he says, well, I'm a banker. And you say it like it's a bad word. I said, no. I just think it will be boring. He said, what do you think being a banker is? And I said, yeah, sitting around minding other people's money all day. And his wife laughed. And he says, that's not what I do at all. And he said, if you're interested, we have a management training program. We're choosing 13 people from the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And after 9 months, you can become a branch manager if you complete it, if you're selected. And he gave me his card. And I said, okay, thanks. Put it in my pocket, went home and put it in the shoebox. I had probably 70, 80 cards in there from people who had been telling me, hey, I like the way you do business. Come work for me. And I just didn't know what I was meant to do next, so I didn't do anything. And then I called him one day and said, hey, I don't know if you remember me. I'm the guy that works at Copeland's. He said, yes, Victor. He called my name out after 3, 4 months. He said, Victor, yeah, I remember. I said, hey, can I come down and hang out and see what you do? I think I'm ready to do something else. And he said, sure. Went down the next day, spent time in the community. He went to a school and spoke. He let me sit in on a business meeting. And after about 3 or 4 hours, it was lunchtime. And he says, that's what a banker does. I said, dude, I would love to be able to do this. You know, what do I need to do? He says, well, let me see if I can get you in. We have a round of interviews. Everyone else has been through them. Let me see if I can get you in. And I don't know what he said, because the 4 days later, he called me and said, you got a suit? Can you wear your suit? Come up here to 901 Main Street, the 74, 73 story building in downtown Dallas. And some people want to meet you. And, of course, I had no idea what to expect. He set up 7 interviews back to back to back, 7 interviews with executives from the bank to see if I could qualify for this program. And at that time, we had pagers. And by the time I got to my car, my pager was going off. Went and found a payphone. He said, you're in. Everybody loved you. And I was like, okay, what happens? He said, and this was a Friday. He said, Monday, you start. I think it's $35,000. I was making 22, I think, and I was happy to have 22. He said, it starts at 33,000 and you get bonuses. And I was like, man, well, wait a minute, whoa. What do I have to do to make that kind of money? Because, I mean, I was 24 years old, and that was a lot of money. That was more money than I was making almost as much money as my mom. So he said, come on in. And I went through the 9-month training program. I finished first in my class. And the day I graduated, they said, there's a branch in Houston we want you to take over, and it's failing. And they just moved a big world financial center right across the street, and we want to see if somebody can save it. And they said, you're the guy. And I said, no. When I took the job, you told me that I could finish my master's program and stay in Dallas. And they were like, yeah, but things have changed. I talked to a couple of sages in the company. They said, if you go to Houston and fix this, you write your own ticket. I packed up my stuff over the weekend, called my mom once I got to Houston and said, oh, by the way, I live in Houston now and I work for Nations Bank. And I thought I had arrived. After about a year, year and a half, I got promoted 3 times back to Dallas at a much bigger bank, making a lot more money. And I was sitting in my office with an executive assistant twice my age and bored to death playing solitaire on a computer 6 hours a day. The days that I didn't stay in the office, I go shopping, you know, hit some golf balls, you know, go to a strip club, whatever I wanted to do, you know, some ridiculous stuff for a 20-something-year-old. I had more money than I knew what to do with. And then one day somebody handed me a book and said, you need a hobby because it's obvious you're not happy in this job. And this is a good job, but it's obvious that you're successful in it, but you're not happy. Guy handed me a book. I read the book and said, this is cool. This is what I want to do next. And I started writing just like that. And after the first book was complete, I sold it out of my trunk, sold it in beauty and barbershops, sold about 3,000 copies in a couple of months. And so I'm sitting here with $30,000-$40,000 from book sales saying, hey, I think I can do this again. And at the same time, I was trying to get a book deal in New York. And after a while, after being rejected 45 times, I eventually got a book deal. And 15 books later, here I am.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing. I mean, there's so much in there. But before we really open it up and just have the audience sort of, you know, give you, ask you some questions, Alan, I wanted you to, you and Kim focus really on the whole business piece and expanding it, but I know you probably have some other questions. So I wanted to open it up for you to ask some questions of Victor. And then we're going to, talk a little bit about the things that Victor talked about, and highlight some points, and then we'll open it up for the audience to ask some questions.
Sure. First of all, Victor, what an amazing testimony you have. Very, very, very powerful. And as I was listening, I was just I was amazed at how the very thing that you struggled with was where you really got your freedom from is writing. And books. And what I wanted to ask you was, or could you kind of elaborate on, you know, when it really clicked in your mind? When did you really understand that struggle that you had was really was really your most valuable asset? You know, the thing that you struggled with, the thing that you had the most resistance to, was really the jewel that you had inside of you. And when did that really, you know, click, and you were able to understand that and be able to understand that you could translate that into something that would be able to sustain you financially?
Yeah, with me more than anything else, I live by, you know, challenges and benchmarks. And sometimes I would say almost to a fault, but I think it goes back to my running days. And I was an 800 meter runner, one of the toughest events in track and field, where it's speed and endurance. And a lot of people would kind of, you know, turn away from an event that required so much planning, so much strategy, so much just attention and detail during a race, and all of the execution that came out afterwards. And of course, these aren't the things you think about at the time. You just think, I got to be faster than the next guy. But when you get older, you realize what's required to run that event. And challenging myself to not only be successful at something, but finding out what it was that I needed to do. Because I think most of us, you know, we have goals, we have dreams, you know, which are two totally different things. But we don't spend enough time trying to figure out what it's going to take to make those dreams come true, and to align goals in a way where we can work towards achieving them. A gentleman handed me a book that I was talking about and said, you need a hobby. You know, you're not here in the office a lot of the time. Executives are starting to be concerned. You know, your numbers are up, so they're not going to fire you, but they're not happy about it. And the book was called Brothers and Sisters, and it was written in a bank. And I read the book, told the guy that handed it to me, man, this is awesome, but I didn't like the ending. And he said, what do you mean? I said, I thought it was kind of contrived. You know, just I saw it coming halfway through the book. If I'd written it, I would have made it something like this. And he says, well, you know, since you haven't written a book, and somebody really spent their time, see, this is a person who appreciated literature. He said, since you haven't written a book, you should probably keep your mouth closed about people who can actually pull it off. And I was like, oh, so you don't think I can write a book? And he says, dude, you ain't even read books, and which was true. So after I read the book, told him about it, I said, I'm going to write a book. Well, it took me a year and a half. It took me a year and a half to learn how to complete a manuscript. And after I finished that, I said, here you go. This is the book that I wrote. I think you're going to like the ending better than that book you showed me a year and a half ago. And he was shocked because I hadn't told anybody. And he said, man, that was like 2 years ago. I said, no, it was 17 months ago. But here you go. Here's the book. And then after I felt accomplished, then I said, okay, now, again, this is how I run my life and lead my life to most things. I didn't expect for that to become, like you said, so adequately and adeptly, that would be the freedom that released me from my struggle. Brother, that was deep, because that's exactly what happened. All of my mother ever told me was get a good job and keep it. You know, that's it after college.
That's it, get a good right.
Job. Yeah, and keep it. So when I told her I was leaving banking, she said, I know you're not going to leave that good job. I said, it's not feed my soul. You know, I was kind of I've been reading a lot of Malcolm X and visiting museums. And I just said, I don't know. Again, just like when I left my job working on the phone all day, like at the call center, I don't know what I'm supposed to do, but I know this is not it. And that's what moved me off my spot. So I left my job as a junior executive in my 20s and started writing full time.
And the rest is history.
Yeah,
I want to put a pin there. I don't know if Kim has some things she wants to add, but I want to put a pin right here, because I believe that a lot of times people are faced with that moment, like you said, and something prevents them from pulling the trigger. Something prevents them from making that jump. There's something in you that the jumping is almost compelling. It's not like you have to be pushed and prodded. It's almost like Steve Jobs says, don't do something that you got to chase after. Do something that pulls you to it. So,
wow, yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like you were just drawn to these things, because the place where you were at wasn't. Like you said, I love that statement. I hope people catch that in the podcast. What you were doing was not feeding your soul. That is the key. And a lot of people sacrifice. They starve their soul in order to have the false security of a job, of getting a paycheck.
Yeah,
they starve their souls, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that, you know, that was why I wanted to bring you on here, Victor, because that is what I want people to understand. Now, I'm not quite sure. Did Kim have, I want to make sure, because, you know, yeah, I want to make sure Kim gets her. It would be incomplete if Kim don't get her say.
Well, Victor, I just want to congratulate you on just following your dreams. I mean, that is such an amazing story. I think it's something that all of us desire, and all of us don't necessarily have the wherewithal or the tenacity or the faith to actually push through and defying all odds, do what actually feeds our soul. And the thing that's so encouraging about your story is that I happen to have my daughters in the car with me, my one daughter that I just picked up from University of Maryland for Thanksgiving break, and they were able to hear your story. And I love it. I love it, because it's so funny that I think what you were saying as a parent, you're always telling your kid, you know, I don't know, get a job, get a good job, get a major.
And don't lose it. And don't lose it.
Right. To get a major that's going to get you a good job, you know. And my daughter, this one in Maryland, has always been one that always wants to take jobs to feed her soul. And to hear your story is so phenomenal because it just kind of solidifies to her that you can actually do what you love and make a great living of it and do what actually feeds your soul. And, you know, they always say in starting a business, whatever you have a pet peeve, whatever bothers you, run to that because you'll probably make a business out of whatever's annoying to you, whatever you have a weakness for. And you did just that. I mean, to not be able to read and to actually start a career with something that at the foundation of it is reading is actually so phenomenal. I mean, so phenomenal. And it's so funny because what I'm always telling my daughter is, what's going to get you a good job? But now I want to change that story up because after hearing you and knowing that I'm in the same place that you are and wanting to do what feeds my soul, I'm going to always tell her to feed her soul. Do what allows you to feed your soul, Kaylin. And you know what's so phenomenal is that she actually works part-time for Starbucks, but she also had an opportunity to work on campus in admissions. And so she's a double major sociology and communication. And I was like, girl, Starbucks job is always going to be there. You need that admissions job. It's an office job. It's going to be great on your resume for communication. And so she was like, no, they want me to work 5 days a week. I said, well, tell them you can work 3 days a week and you can still work your Starbucks job because she loves Starbucks. I said, girl, because she really wants to be a lawyer. I said, well, why do you keep wanting to work at Starbucks, Kaylin? The only type of lawyer you're going to be able to be is a lawyer for Starbucks. You keep wanting to work at Starbucks. But what is so phenomenal, guys, is that just 2 days ago, I heard on Oprah's Super Soul Sunday, she was interviewing the CEO of Starbucks, and he spoke about the foundation of their business is the people. The people are what's the most important part of his business. He doesn't care about anything. He grew up poor. He wanted to make sure he started a business where people could have benefits. They would have insurance, and they could feed their family. And she can get stocked as a part-timer because Starbucks is such a great company. And I remember going in there the other day, and one of her workers was so friendly. I was like, oh, my God, it's so amazing. They make you feel so great. So Kaylin always talks about how great they make her feel. Every time I go in there, they compliment her. They're like, oh, my God, I have to fix your drink. So great because your daughter, she's superb. She's such a great person. And to know that Starbucks is a company that really cares about their people, that's actually the type of company that I would want her to be affiliated with because all the people are wonderful people.
Absolutely.
And so walking through your dream, I just want to ask you, how did you know how to go about actually getting your book published and connecting with book publishers?
Well, this was 1997-98, so the internet was still at its infancy as far as customers like, you know, it's consumed now. Federal government employees had access to it, but a lot of us didn't even know anything about it. So it was still brand new. So there was no Google, there was no Yahoo. So I don't even know what I looked. I don't know which was the first. I looked up book clubs after I had written the book. Well, actually, when I first wrote the book, it was 45 pages. It was done. All I could do after running my mouth was write a book, and it was 45 pages. You know how embarrassing. So I looked online and saw this woman and her daughter that had a business that they teach people how to kind of flesh out manuscripts. And so I called them. I don't even think they had an email at the time, but you know, so I called them on the phone. They were in Cincinnati. I said, "Hey, I just wrote this book, and I don't know what to do. I'm finished, but it's not enough." And they said, "Okay, well, we charge $1 a page. How many pages do you have?" I said, 45. And she said, "It sounded like you said 45. I said, "Yeah, that's all I got." And she said, okay, then it's not really a novella. Tell me about the story. So once I started telling her about the story, she said, that sounds like a lot more than 45 pages. You know, sign this contract, send it to me. And I sent her the manuscript, and they worked. They showed me how to tell the story and show the story instead of tell the story. So after about another 4 months, the manuscript was complete, went online again. And in that short time, that short 4 or 5 months that her and her mom taught me how to help build my story, build my manuscript, there was 2 or 3 book clubs that popped up online. You know, when you learn how to search, and there was New York publishers and also the top agencies. So I sent out probably 200 letters. I have a new book. This is the manuscript. It's great. You're going to love it. And start getting rejections. And every time I open the mailbox, it's stuffed full of rejections. You know, we don't know anybody who writes like this. We don't like the style. We don't think we can market it. And at that time, Omar Tyree, Elin Harris, and Eric Jerome Dickey were starting to make money. They had already written their first or second book. And the publishers that did do African-American fiction were like, you don't write like Eric. You don't write like Elin. You don't write like Omar. And I said, exactly. I tell my stories more like Grisham and Walter Mosley. And they were like, well, yeah, but so, you know. So that's what I did. And after about 43, 44, I think I got up to about 45 rejections. I told my wife, I said, you know, I got to do something else. This is not working out. She said, but you're selling a lot of books. I said, I know. But, you know, on a grand scale, maybe it's just a regional thing. I could sell them in the Southwest. They love my books in California. But I'm not selling any in New York. I'm not selling in New Jersey, in the Pennsylvania area. So she said, okay, why don't you go ahead and go to Chicago, which was my last big book signing. It was a Deltas National Convention, and there were 10,000 Deltas there. And I think I had maybe 80 books, my last 80 books. She said, sell those. You sell them, that's 800 bucks. Come on home, and, you know, you gave it a good run. I sold those 80 books in about an hour, and I was supposed to be there for 2 days. And I did the same thing I did when I was waiting tables. I spoke to everybody that came by. How you doing? I'm Victor McLaughlin. Just got it from Dallas. I have a new book. You probably haven't heard of it, but it's killing them in Texas. They love it in California. And but you know, some of the Saras were saying, hey, I'm from California. I think I might have heard of this book. I don't even know if that was true or not. But I was smiling big, and I was hugging and taking pictures. You know, and everybody had their little, you know, Polaroids and that kind of stuff. And I was signing books. And a crowd formed. Next thing you know, security had to come and make a line for me because there were so many people standing in line trying to see what this book was that everybody was talking about. But I hand sold 80 books in about an hour. And Kimla Lawson Roby was sitting next to me. She said, I never heard of you or your book, but you can sell books. Why don't you have a deal? I told her my problem. She said, I have an agent who might be able to help you. Her agent called me. That was a Friday, Saturday. Her agent called me on a Tuesday and said, I would like to represent you. I hadn't even read the book, but Kimbala says you were selling like crazy. And so I had to get more books printed than her one in Pennsylvania. She called me, oh my goodness. She called me 2 weeks later. After that, I'd forgotten about it because I'd already been turned down by so many people. I said, she's a nice lady, but there's no way. She got me a 2-book hardcover deal just like that. So It was me trying to figure out what to do next. And I was going to continue to do whatever was next. And next was, and after all those no's, and Patrick and I talked about this, to me, I guess I'm a salesman of sorts, because to me, no means next. No doesn't mean no.
That's
it
right.
Just means next.
Right.
So when somebody,
right.
When someone says no to you, it's like, okay, no just means not this time. So I'm going to go to somebody
right.
else. And my wife even said it. She was like, you get all these rejections. You know, sometimes it's just not meant to be. And I said, you know what, you're right. I'm willing to accept that if that is the case. So I was willing to put it on hold and go and do something else. And it happened just like it needed to. I was down to my last couple of books. I was stripped down. I was, as they say on the streets, I was knocked on my humble. People telling me how great my book was, and I couldn't get anybody to buy it and as far as a publisher. So I was self-publishing. I think I printed them for like $350, and I was selling them for $10-11. So I was making $8 a book, which isn't bad, especially when you're selling 3,000-4,000 of them. You know, out of the
you was getting all the profit because you was doing all the work, right?
Yeah, So you know, I'm selling my.
What was the name of the first book?
My first book was In Spite Of, and the second book was Autumn Leaves, and those are the two that I self-published, and that turned into hardcover book deals. And
so
it's kind of, you know.
Yeah, so, Victor, because we coming up on the end, and I want to give the people, the audience out there, opportunity to ask questions if they choose. So, but I just want to, you know, just encapsulate a couple of things that I want everybody who listens to this podcast, everybody who's on the call right now, listening right now, to really highlight some things about Victor's story. You know, first and foremost, you know, we talked about, you know, your gifts making room for you, and Victor knew, sometimes you don't know what your gift, but you know that whatever you're doing is not your gift, that is not. And I think that what a lot of times we need to be comfortable with is the uncomfortability of knowing that what we're doing is not what we're supposed to do, and putting ourselves in a position to be able to explore and find out what we're called to do. A lot of people won't do that. They take a bird in the hand, beats two in the bush mentality. So they'll hold on to this crow that's crapping in their hand and won't let go until they see, you know, that beautiful eagle or bird that they're supposed to be. And sometimes you got to let go of that bird, and you got to go and pursue. Because what I love the most about your story is when you knew that it wasn't for you, and it wasn't feeding your soul, you just hightailed it out. Now, there's a couple of things about that. You did a lot of this when you were young, right? So
right. Yes, when I was idealistic.
Right, when you were idealistic. So, you know, that equation gets a lot different when you're married and you have kids, but it does not eliminate the possibility of you pursuing your dreams, because I believe the scripture is true when it says your gifts will make room for you. So, you know, I just want to highlight these things, and I want to highlight how when you pursue your dreams, and when you are, you know, I think Victor always was gifted in writing. I think that sometimes your situation and your circumstance, God puts you in a place of crisis or trial in order to bring the gift out. So for whatever reason, God didn't allow you to be in an environment initially that brought out your gift. But
yeah, well, let me tell you this, Patrick, because you just said some things that are key to me. I'll be 50 this month. And 4 months ago, I left a six-figure job where I was a corporate trainer. And I left that corporate trainer because they were asking me to do that and also be the internal communications manager for the company, which I also did. And then they were piling on other duties. And I kept explaining to them, I can't do more. There's not enough hours in the day. I'm already getting home at 7 o'clock and I'm exhausted. I'm going to sleep. I can't keep doing this. And they thought I was joking because they knew they were paying me well. They thought, you know, he's going to take the money. He's doing a good enough job, so we don't have to hire anybody else. So I left. I quit. I talked to my wife. She said, yes, that job is killing you, and you won't be any good to anybody if you stroke out. All you're going to do is go out and hire two people to do what you've been doing. And she was right. So just 4 months ago, I quit a great paying job to what I do call participate in my purpose. And I believe my purpose at this point is to get an education. So, as you know, I wrote The Student Formula, How to Win in Inner City Classrooms. That's my 15th book. It's my first nonfiction, and I think the most important thing I'll ever write. And it teaches inner city kids, middle school to high school, how to win in education. We can't do anything about the teachers. Either you get good ones or you don't. We can't do anything about your school. You're in a good one or you're not. But we can do two things. We can help promote them and teach them how to be successful in their own education and the strategies that go along with that, and also provide strategies for their parents who've always wanted to help their kids be successful but didn't know how. So the book is out. It came out last month. It's been endorsed by educators and administrators from Berkeley to New Jersey. So I honestly believe that is, for whatever reason, in the next chapter of my life, at this point, my purpose is to help educate inner city kids across the nation.
Awesome. I wish Milton could unmute him or whatever, but he might give us his cold over the phone the way he's coughing right now. So but I'm highlighting that because you said some key words. You talked about strategies. You talked about winning. These are the things that we're trying to promote with what we're doing. So I'm going to open up the call. I'm going to unmute everybody and just give people the opportunity to ask you questions, Victor, because I'm sure they have questions. And please, audience, do not hesitate to ask questions. This is a great opportunity. There could be some nuggets, some things that Victor can speak into your life that can be a blessing to you. So I'm going to unmute. I'll let you guys know when everybody's unmuted. So does anybody have any questions? Everybody's unmuted now.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Hey, Victor. How you doing? How you doing, Patrick? This is Nina. And
good,
I have a
Nina,
question.
How are you?
Doing okay. I'm excited to hear about you being such a great mentor and being able to help us and being able to go after our dreams. And for me, it's been that, you know, how do you get over, like you did, you know, being told what you were told so young? Because I had an incident that happened when I was a little girl, and sometimes it still haunts me. And I know that there's greatness inside of me. I know that I'm a very innovative person, and I've gone through a whole lot in my career, and I've become an entrepreneur and all of this. But I know that there is a true writer inside of me because I have a passion for what I believe in. But the thing is sometimes, especially when it comes to public speaking, I have a tendency to feel that ghost that follows me from the past of what I was told. And so I'm like, how do you get past that? Because to be who you need to become and go after your dreams, because I know I'm a speaker also, and I know that there's a writer inside of me.
One of the things that I put in this book, and again, by writing the book, I learned a lot about myself. And this is something that I tell my sons. I have two teenage sons. Sometimes you have to hustle like you have no choice.
Okay.
You have to hustle like you have no choice. If your eating had to depend on your next move, how would you go about it differently? If speaking in public is something that, you know, you're dealing with the angst because of something you were told a long time ago, what if you had no choice and you had to do it? How would you attack that struggle? How would you attack that issue then?
Well, I've had to do that. That's exactly what I've had to do. It never stopped me. It's just that you have this, and, you know, we're talking about fears and things that kind of make you feel apprehensive. But I noticed I've been on platform several times with teaching and mentoring and all of that. And initially I feel this haunting, this shivering. But what I do is I press past it and I become comfortable, but I hate that shiver. It's a strange feeling that you feel.
Nina, you might need to remind yourself that you're good at it. And I think if you remind yourself that you already know you're good at it, then that might take some of the anxiety out of it. One of the things that happened after, I think, my fourth or fifth book, and I had taken a year off and done some other things, and when I got my next book deal, it was a multi-book deal, and I was terrified. I was terrified that what if I can't do it again? What if I can't amuse my readers? What if I just, you know, I've lost it? And I just had to keep reminding myself, I've already done it, so I know I can do it. People like what I got to offer, just like they do you. So you already know that you can do it well. So maybe just remind yourself, you got this, and blow through all of that anxiety that normally comes with it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
No,
that's what I'm.
No worries.
All right, I've been knowing Nina since how are we, Nina? Six, seven, five years, something like that. Yeah, 40 plus years.
That's right.
She was beautiful then, and she's beautiful now. Anybody else have any? I didn't want to interrupt you, Nina, if you had another question.
No. That was the main thing. It's encouraged me, and I'm going to do it no matter what it feels like. I'm going to get on through that shiver and be confident and be courageous in what I've been called to do. So I appreciate that very much.
Amen.
There you go. Participate in your purpose. I love it.
Anybody else have any questions? Do not miss this opportunity, everyone. All right. You sure? Y'all sure? Everybody good?
Let me ask one other question since it's still kind of silent. When are you going to have the next podcast? When will the next one be?
They're going to be every Tuesday at 7:30. So well, that's 7:30 Eastern, so it's 6:30 our time Central.
Okay. And then one other question for Victor. When you're trying to do your manuscript, I know I have several book titles, but there's one particular that I'm working on. What happens when your idea that you initially started with is started broadening out into something else? So that's what's happening to me, and then I'm doing a lot of research on the type and the subject matter of the book, but sometimes I'm getting this feeling where, okay, there's a lot of people got, a lot of books. How is mine going to stand out above all the rest?
Mm-hmm. Whether it's your title or the subject matter, when you're working on a manuscript, my suggestion, and it's always been the same since I started, is let it take you where it wants to go.
Okay.
And then once you get there, then you can reevaluate if the title needs to be changed, if the way you continue doing research changes. But when you're blessed with a story, mm-hmm. you blessed with a way to present help in a self-help type of book, mm-hmm. I call it the book gods are smiling on you and raining down ideas in your head. And as long mm-hmm. as they are on your side, just go mm-hmm. with it, because you can always edit later, you can always adapt later, but some people, oh my goodness, Nina, just so many people are like, I've had ideas for a book. I don't want to mess up, or I'm afraid I'll have to change mm-hmm. some things. It's like, mm-hmm. just like life, if you get started in it and you're doing it right, some things are going to have to adapt. So let it take you where it wants to go. And at the end of that, decide how you want to be.
I got you. Because one thing that I notice that happens, and I know that the writing is fine, because once I get started, it's hard for me to stop writing. It's like pouring water out of a glass almost.
Yeah, you got the writing gods are smiling on you, so keep it moving.
Okay, thank you.
Awesome. Uh-huh. So I did see somebody just dial in from Arlington. I didn't know if they had any questions they wanted to ask you, Victor. I wanted to just sort of close with something.
Can I ask him what is the average amount of pages that manuscript should be?
It depends. If you're talking about a fiction novel, anywhere from 70 to 100 and whatever thousand words. So usually mine are around 90 to 95,000 words. That's where I feel comfortable telling a story. So anywhere between 270 to 315 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But, there are a lot of novels that are smaller that do well. So it depends. What I suggest is go to a bookstore, and the types of books that you like, go and look at them and see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really like that piece you said about just letting your writing take you wherever, mm-hmm. Down the path that it takes you, and just follow it out to its end, right? So, yeah, I like mm-hmm. that. I want to close with one. First, I want to thank you again, Victor.
Thank you.
I just want to thank you.
Your
story,
yeah.
Compelling, and I hope that everyone that's on the line really got something from it. It's chock full of this type of rich story. You're gonna need to download the podcast and listen to it again and again. And yes, Al and I did hit the record button. So,
I heard it. I heard it. Brother.
Yeah.
Heard
so.
It.
But I want to close with something. I don't know if a young man, Marcus Bruno, said something really interesting to me that I want to close this call with. When I was talking to Alan said to me, we sort of talked in the morning. We tend to try to talk every day. He said, man, I just want to tell you, I appreciate you. I love you because you stirred up the gift in me. And so when he said it to me, it sort of quickened something in me. And so I knew that statement had a scriptural foundation. So I went into the scriptures, and I read that scripture. And the reason why I mention Marcus is because Marcus had mentioned in our group, and those of you that aren't a part of the Your Gift Will Make Room for You group, you know, hit me up and I'll add you. But there was a statement that he made. He said, you know, he said, Patrick, recently heard a quote from our pastor. He said, God isn't after your gifts. He's after your courage. And so what Marcus said is it reminded me that fear can keep my gift hidden from the world if I don't walk by faith and not by sight. And the reason why that struck me, because when I went to the scripture, here's what 2 Timothy says, verse 6. I remind you to stir up the gift of God which is in you. And then here's what verse, that's the first part of that, is the second part, but that's the first part of verse 6. Verse 7 says, for God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. So I want to connect people with the understanding that when you have a gift and it's stirred up, what God has called you to do is really operate not from a spirit of fear, but a power, love, and a sound mind. They are connected. So I was listening to Nina talk, and I know Nina. I've been knowing mm-hmm. Nina. I mean, we've been knowing each other since, you know, that's watching right. cartoons and eating cereal. Mm-hmm. So
that's right. That's a long time.
Yeah, a long time. So, my point is that I want everybody to understand that if you are to operate in your gift, do not be surprised if a spirit of fear attempts to come over you, but be encouraged because God did not give that to you. That wasn't given you. He gave you something different. So when you operate in fear relative to your gift, you're not operating in the divine. You're really operating in the demonic.
Good word. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to leave that with y'all because I think that's a very important point. I hope I'm going to give everybody one more chance. Is everybody good? You don't have any questions you want to ask Victor or me or Alan or Kim? If everybody's good,
no.
Then I'm
going to. Yeah. Yeah,
okay, I'm going to close the call. Thank you again. Thank you so much, Victor. Thank you, everybody who showed up for the call. The podcast will be up shortly. You can download it on iTunes, and you can download it on Google Play also for those of you that don't have an iPhone.
For all right. the Android users.
Yeah, for all the Android users. Yeah, I love everybody. So, hey, y'all have a blessed evening. And until next week, I hope y'all join us again. Be blessed.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Thank you, Vic.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.